Welcome to the podcast where we talk to guests about five moments in their lives they'll never forget. This is Backstory with Steve Legg.
It's fabulous to have you with me today on the new show, where I bring together an incredible array of stars of stage and screen, stand-up comedians and magicians, writers and artists, leaders and entrepreneurs, to chat about the five significant times in their lives they'll never forget. It's great to have you here.
And my guest today is the brilliant Jonathan Vieira, an internationally acclaimed bass baritone opera singer who's performed across the globe with various companies, including Glyndebourne, the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden and the Royal Danish Opera Company. His performances and operatic comedy roles have thrilled audiences at home and abroad, but JV sings much more than opera alone. This multi-skilled entertainer with a range as big as his heart and character has performed across the globe to great reviews, both in opera and in his own one-man show. He's also very well known in the Christian community for his Christian and gospel albums. There's no doubt about it, he's a very funny and supremely talented guy. And here he is, Jonathan Vieira.
Hello, and thank you.
Come on, they're going mad here in Littlehampton. Hello.
Oh, listening to that, I can tell you, I'm starting to quite like this guy.
He sounds good.
Yeah, he sounds very talented. I'm excited to see him someday when we can all get out and go to a show.
Jonathan, have you thought about your opening line, your first proper gig after lockdown? Have you been thinking about it for the last 18 months?
You know what? I sat there, Stephen, honestly, I'm 60 now. I've been performing for 36, 37 years, and I can't remember a time ever like this where I hadn't been out in front of an audience for, I mean, it would only be maximum four weeks, that max, when I was on holiday. And I never ran out of things to say. And what I thought was, am I still funny? Can I still do this? I don't know whether I can still, what will I say? I think what I've settled on is, evening. That's what I've settled on, that evening. I don't want to go. I thought I'd be understated.
That is definitely understated. You have been incredibly busy with your Sunday night shows. It was lovely being a guest on there. You've got an amazing posse and a following.
Oh, it's incredible, actually. And they love having you. They love magic, mate. And I'm back off the show because after this operation I've just had. I'm planning the next few months. So let's have you back on. I need at least somebody cut in half. And I don't want anything less. I need a full body in half, wagging the fingers and moving the neck. Okay? If you got one of those that you bought from Bob's Magic Shop, then I think I need to see it. All right?
Do you know what? After we've done this, I'm gonna phone Bob and see what he can do.
Great. I did try magic, but I was no good at it. My wife said, I think you should stick to the vocals, love.
I don't believe that. You are seriously now, you are one of the most talented men I know. How many instruments can you play?
Three, four, probably five. I mean, I did try lots of different ones. As a musician, you kind of, when you start off in your career, you kind of suck it and see, if it's going to work, if that's going to work, then you try the clarinet. If that doesn't work, you try the violin. Doesn't try that, you try the viola. Then you try, and I tried the French horn. And then I tried loads of instruments, and it helps me in my understanding of the orchestra as well, to do that. Playing guitar, of course, everybody plays. You can pick up a guitar and play that. Bit of banjo, but I wrote a song recently on the banjo, just around the bend, my new song with Paul Field. And we did that, and I wrote that on the banjo, which is quite fun. And then the accordion and all those things that are related. And every now and again, my producer, Mark Edwards, he allows me to play one of these on the album, and then I can put mouth organ. Vera,
Love it. Tell me the difference.
I love it.
Sorry, John. Tell me the difference between a banjo and a ukulele.
Right, a different stringing. You've got you have a five string on the, if you imagine the film Deliverance, that one. Right, they have what's called a drone string, which the drone is like a bagpipe, just keeps going on that, and then you pluck around the rest of them. So you're plucking the first string of that banjo, and the rest of them, the other four strings, that's from the five string banjo, that you then do the claw hammer, all that stuff. All right. So a ukulele, the tiny little one, is tuned usually differently, and it's a very the uke. Well, it's come into popularity recently, and it's a very different type of instrument. It's a kind of a miniature guitar. It's usually the last four strings of the guitar, whereas the ukulele is tuned. The tuning is different. The sound is different. The what's required. I went and bought, well, my wife went and bought for me one year, a guitar banjo, which is, means that they string it just like a guitar. And because if you play the guitar, then it's easy to play. So you end up playing, it makes you look good. Even though you're not quite, the king of banjo playing, but it's great. I love having it, and I use it quite a lot on albums. I do. I like the sound. Other people, when I did a recording in Nashville, they hated it. They always used to say, really, you want a banjo as well? Really? and I said, yeah. They said, well, here, you know, if you want to get rid of one, what do you do? You always come out and you put a banjo in the car, and if you're unfortunate, you come back and find two. That's the kind of thing. Everybody's wanted to get rid of it. So it's very strange. But I love the sound of a banjo, and it's such an improvised sound, you know. Mm. But they can never, you can never get them in tune. They're ridiculous tune. Just the way it is. Pianos, you know where you are with them more. They at least they stay in tune more. That's it, my Steinway. Stays in tune with me more for the gig. So.
That is a soundbite. Anyway. That is a soundbite. You know where you are with a piano. that could be a JV catchphrase.
You can't drag it down the road. If you're on tour, you can't drag a Steinway, can you? You can't kind of hook it onto the back. You could if you've got wheels, I suppose. But I love pianos. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. I've given away another one. So I've got, you know, various rooms that Steinway in one, a Bechstein in the up and the other. And I've got a studio where I've got a number of, you know, electric keyboards. So I love pianos, and I can't walk past one because I just it's so rich in tone, and you can do so many things with it. You know, that's what I love.
Well,
that's my love.
My anyway, mate right. Phil Blake, when we were at school, I used to play in brass bands, so interested in music.
Really?
Yes. So
what did you play?
I played E-flat bass, which is like a big tuba type thing, but I love the sound of brass bands much more than orchestras, personally. I've not played since I left school at 16.
How ridiculous.
I know, isn't that mad?
It is mad. And part of the reason I say that, I mean, I love having chats with people about music because I'm a lecturer as well. You see, I lecture at a university. Was given an honorary degree, and they one of the things they said, could you come and teach, on the BMUG course, the Bachelor of Music course. Mm. So I'm one of the tutors on that. And I love to just encourage everybody to just play music. Music, particularly during this lockdown, has been a real kind of relief for me. I've just found a way of understanding the world. That's how I see the world, through a prism of music. And musicians, that's partly how they see the world. And it's a shame when you say you played it up until you were 16 or 18 or whatever you did, whenever they threw you out in 1946 from school. And
83, thank you very much.
Well, all right, you're such a young boy.
Babyface.
I'm just an old geezer. 86. What year did you leave?
83. I left at 16. So cool. I'm 54 now.
You're 54. No, you are a young man, aren't you? Young, good-looking, and with hair. And I'm just a bald old coot, and I just that's the way I am. But I have to say, music. Look, I try and say to everybody, if you've done it before, get back into it because it. I know you do magic, and I know you're a communicator. But music is a wonderful way of seeing the kaleidoscope of creativity. If that's what it is, and that's another soundbite. How about that?
Thank you,
the
mate.
The kaleidoscope of creativity.
It doesn't beat You Know Where You Are with a Piano. That is my all-time favourite. But seriously, every Christmas, you know, there's nothing like a brass band or even a brass quartet. So,
Well, I'm, yeah, I agree with you. And in fact, to that end, you know, the reason I'm asking is because the church that I go to, we do a big carol service. We have about 75, 80 in the choir. We have a wind band of about 15 to 18. And I only do wind bands. I don't bother with strings because so you have to have so many of them to make a difference. Mm. So what we do is we have, you know, three trumpets, a flugel, French horn, two or three trombones, a euphonium. So we get that real fat Salvation Army.
Beautiful.
Sound, you know, and it does. I used that sound on a recent album to close the album. We said we. And I put it into four parts. And it was like when the Salvation Army used to come down your street in the 1960s. And you could hear them from a distance. They would walk and then they would play hymns on a Sunday morning. And everybody would come out and they'd just play the hymns. They wouldn't sing them, just play them. And then walk away playing them. That's what I put on the back end of an album. So, anyway.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get one for this Christmas.
Get
any flat bass?
Come and see mine. Come and be part of. I'd love you to get your lips going for that again.
Well, it was going to take a while, isn't it, to get the embouchure back? We're talking very technical musical terms here.
Yeah, it would. It would. But think of the joy. If you can get it back, and all we do, I get them to play six carols. So basically, it's really tight. Really lovely, and people, the congregation come in their hundreds to come and feel part of that thing. But brass band, it's like a warm blanket, isn't it? I don't know what it is, but it puts its arm around you and gives you a little cuddle and says, all's right with the world.
Totally. Okay,
anyway,
challenge accepted. Jonathan Vieira, thanks for coming on the show. Let's get started.
It's been 12 minutes already.
So five memories, mate, that you'll never forget. Yeah. That kind of shaped you a little bit. So tell us about meeting the lovely Sue.
Well, you see, it's been now coming up nearly 40 years since we've been married, but about 42, 43 since we've met each other. And I went to university, okay, and it must have been October. Would it be October, Sue? Something like that. Yeah, she's shouting yes, but she's disagreeing on all the things that I say, just in case I exaggerate, just for the sake of emphasis, you understand.
Of course.
The apocryphal is very much part of what I do. But she said October 1979, and I met her, and I have to say, I'm just an ordinary red-blooded man, and I remember looking at her and thinking, I did. I have to say that because that was true. And she's a beautiful woman. And she really, and I thought to myself, now there's a beautiful woman, but she's way outside my club, you know, way outside anything that I could, I've been batting way above that. And anyway, long story short, ended a relationship with a girl at university. And my wife, she, well, as she is now, she comforted me, and she comforted me to the sound of Art Garfunkel. I believe when I fall in love with you.
Oh, yes. I'm swaying.
Remember that one?
I do.
I believe when I fall in love with you, it's before ever. And she was looking at me, and she's like, I believe when I fall in love. Love, spelled L-U-R-V-E, was in the air, Steve. And I remember thinking, goodness, this is one of those times when you'll never ever forget the moment that you thought hello. And what it was, I was in, we used to visit a Borstal together on behalf of the church, so we do visit Borstal visiting way back when.
You're such a smoothie, what a date.
Oh yeah, well, it was really weird. And I used to go and speak in the chapel to the boys and go and sing them a song, you know, and their lives are fairly dull. And Sue would go in as this beautiful woman, and they would all crowd to speak to her, of course. And but I'd sing the song, and I was speaking up there, and she suddenly, I could see her in the audience, and I thought, I think something's going on here. Anyway, we went that night to a party, and she twisted her ankle when it was in Clapham. When we were young, it was young, she twisted her ankle dancing. And I just said to her, those fateful words, would you like me to rub that ankle for you? And she said, yes. And the rest, my darling boy, is history. And three children later, and a whole life later, and a woman who's lived probably one of the most kind people I think I've ever known. Kind to animals and dogs and to me. And I think she's kind to nearly everybody. I think that's just who she is. And it's been quite stunning to know a woman like that. And I'll tell you a little bit more about her a bit later on in another question, because it all came to a head. But, you know, now that does not mean to say that we have not had difficult times, and we have. I've had a touring life for decades, and life was difficult, and there were moments, I'm sure, she, when she thought, you've got to be having a laugh. I could have had an easier life with, and a richer life with somebody else. Could have had a bigger house, but she doesn't. She's never, in all those years, wanted more. She's got something what the Bible calls a godly contentment. That means she's happy with where she is.
Beautiful.
She doesn't hanker after stuff. She's not out saying, I want you to burn more money. Never done that. She's never been like that. And for 40 years coming up, I still can't believe. As my father said to me, he said, Jonathan, when you married Sue, you married up. It's a phrase that you don't often hear, but marrying up. So, that's it. That's my first memory, was meeting her, seeing her for the first time. And I can't, it's too rude to say that I saw her in her corduroy trousers first. All right?
Cool.
That's all I'm going to say. All right? That's all I'm saying.
And I love
it. 1979. And it was a happy meeting.
Love it, Jonathan.
This is the Backstory Podcast with Steve Legg and friends.
So, Jonathan Vieira, have you always been able to sing?
That's an interesting question, Stephen. I suppose, yes, in that we were always encouraged. I went to a very, very strict Christian upbringing called the Christian Brethren, and we had to sing. Everybody sung. Everybody sung. But my father was the cantor in the service. They wouldn't have a piano. He would start. Or an organ, and in the morning services, and they would have the communion services, they called them, breaking of bread, and they would start. He would start every hymn, so he would start it. He would start it in whatever key. So it wasn't, and invariably he got it right. But what we would then do is we would go around singing in all the women's meetings, all everywhere. And so we were like the Vera von Trapp of the Christian Brethren, and. We go around singing, and we were singing in harmony. And we just, I suppose, you know, we had piano lessons since I was about 8 or 9, and I started learning about harmony. But my parents were always singing. They were always singing. And I must have picked it up from my dad, who just played a very simple guitar, and we'd do thirds above, that kind of simple harmony. And I guess, I didn't even when I was in the profession for all that time, I was never aware that my voice was that special. It was other people who decided that I was, quote, the voice of the one of the voices of the century. And I thought, I don't recognize that, but clearly something developed when I was a child, and certainly when I was doing school stuff. I was the king in The King and I, and my music teacher at that time, Ian Lawrence, bless his cotton socks, was still a family friend, he said he recognised it. There was something I had it, whatever it was, and he wrote that in the Wilsdon and Brent Chronicle in about 1975, I think it was.
I think it's called the X Factor these days, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it was the X Factor. But I never, and even now, I don't recognise it. I know that people like it, and 15, 16 albums later, people are buying it, and they got it. Whatever it is, so I suppose, I've always sung, but I always thought singing was I always favoured the instrumentalist. I always thought it was more clever to be an instrumentalist than it was to be a singer.
Mm.
A singer, well, you do what you do.
Anyone can do that, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not, clearly not. But and I worked very hard to become good, I guess, and I did a lot of work on it academically as well to make sure I could remember as an opera singer, you don't use microphones. Sure. You're in an opera house, which is you and the orchestra and an opera house. That's it. So you're singing out to 2,500 people without a microphone. It's a big thing.
Wow. Big thing. So you've recorded 16 plus albums. Have you ever won a competition?
Yeah.
And tell us about winning a competition.
I mean, it was 1984, 85, I think it was. I was a postgraduate. I'd done London University. I'd done a degree in music and in English. And then I went on to do postgraduate studies. And I got a scholarship to do this. And then my singing teacher entered me for a very big international sing competition. I had no idea what I was doing. Literally, I thought, oh, well, I'll learn lots of very difficult songs in German, French, Italian, very, very esoteric stuff. And it was terrible. And I eventually got through to the final round of this competition, the Peter Pears singing competition, that particular one. And I got through to the final, and I was the last one on. And then they announced the winner, and they announced third, second, and I was the first one. I won, and I was so shocked. I mean, I can remember thinking, "I wonder who's that?" They're announcing Jonathan Vera, and it was like an out of body experience. I thought, "Who's that? Who's won?" And it wasn't humility. It was just I don't recognize when people talk about me in hallowed terms. Thank the Lord. I think it's the best way. You are who you are. You know, I'm just a boy from North London, but clearly people like to think I had a talent. And so I went with it, and I won this competition. And then in the same week, and I won, at that point, that was 94, 84, something like that, and I won £1,000 that night. And then, and it was tax-free. And I was 24 years old, okay? £1,000. And then I went in, and they'd entered me for another competition that week, the Capital Radio competition. And it was a big, big competition. And I went in and I won £3,500 that day. So within a week, I'd won £4,500 or so. And we couldn't believe it. And one of the things it did was it then got me in the big national newspapers when they started talking in these, you know, this fantastic new singer, blah, blah, blah. And I then went to an opera house, Glyndebourne Opera House, which is a very famous opera house in East Sussex and West Sussex, and I joined that company, and the rest, as they say, was then history. It took time, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But it was a very tough apprenticeship, but that was the entry into that world, which I had no idea about. I mean, I have to tell you this, not a clue. I didn't know which way was up. And I was thrown in at the deep end with all these incredibly talented people. Mm. I had a form of dyslexia where it was I couldn't read music quickly. I had to do it slowly and methodically and learn it more thoroughly than most people. I wasn't a linguist, which most people were, and they came from Oxbridge, you know, Oxford or Cambridge.
Yep.
And you know, I come from a provincial university, London University. It wasn't particularly at the top, and so I was really battling with it. But that the competition was the shock. I'll be honest with you, and nobody was more shocked than I was when we won it. My wife thought, "I'll have all of that money," and that was that. Yeah, so
brilliant.
Winning singing competitions—how they change your life. They do
totally, John.
This is Lieutenant Columbo, and you're listening to Steve Legg's Backstory Podcast, the most fun you can have without a cigar and a trench coat. All right, I think I bothered you enough today. I'll let you go ahead and listen. Oh, one more thing. Enjoy the show.
So, Jonathan Vera, I knew you'd like that one. That's good.
I love that.
Oh, yeah. I used to have Donald Trump here as well, but we can't use him anymore. Well, we could, but...
Thank the Lord for that. Did you do an interview with him?
No, I wouldn't want to. But we won't get on to that.
Thank the Lord for that. Good.
So, John, things were going well. Then 1989 hit and illness came. Can you talk to us about that?
That was an amazing shock because I'd been mentioned in dispatches, and there was I just finished doing another course called the Opera, National Opera Studio, which kind of they have the top of the top people going, and it's like a finishing school for opera singers. And I'd been working by then in the profession, and Covent Garden and Glyndebourne sponsored me to go to this 1 year course, and it, well, 9 months, and it gave you, it's like a kind of a shop window for the world. And I went and sung there, and then I was compared to, at that point, the voice was compared to one of the great baritones of our time, Ingvar Wicksell, who was a Swedish baritone. And this was, the Guardian had said this was one of the great, Ed Greenfield, and the Guardian had said, you know, this is one of the voices, and blah, 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 all of this stuff, which I accepted with gratitude. And I went into Glyndebourne to do the Marriage of Figaro, the opera by Mozart, and I had a headache that day, 23rd of June, and I came back with a really terrible headache. I didn't feel well at all. So I just came home, and it was my wife's birthday. And the rest I was recorded by Sue, because what happened was I went into a coma and gave her a birthday present and went into a coma. And then I had something called viral encephalitis, and they took me in, and they thought I was going deeper into the coma, and my whole life changed. So from being the next best thing, the rumors then went around within the profession that I had got mad cow disease, would you believe, honestly. At that time, just the, and this is a rumour mongering, and it's what happens. They're not all terribly lovely and nice and lovely, as you would think they are. It's actually the rumour mongering starts, and I was quite seriously ill for 3 days. I was known as going deeper into the coma, and various people from churches and peace were coming and praying and being there. And internationally, there was lots of prayer going up. And my wife, we had Matthew by then, who was only two. He's now 34, and they said, what does he do? They asked Sue, what does he do? And so she said, well, he's an opera singer. And they said, not anymore. He's going deeper into the coma, and basically it's like you, when you've had that kind of illness, you don't go back into mainstream work at all. You know, it would be like the effect of having a stroke. So a severe stroke, if you do come round. Mm. And one nurse came up to her and said, we got a postcard from somebody who had this last year. And he wrote it in his own handwriting.
Oh, man.
She thought she was being a comfort to Sue. They came and they said, look, we've done a brain scan and we can find nothing significant. And Sue burst out laughing. I thought she was hysterical. He said, no. JB would love that. They would absolutely love that. I would have. So that was on the third day. And then I, amazingly and miraculously, was the word that the consultant used. He said, I don't understand this. I gave you a scan at this point, and it was, you were completely, your brain was swimming in pus at one point. And he said, and now you're awake. And I've done another scan, and it's not there. It's as though it wasn't there. And it was, that I did a TV program about that, but it was mind blowing, and it was life changing, because I was aiming for the top. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be rich, famous, want the whole nine yards, you know, big house, swimming pool, the lot, and to be known as one of the best in the world. That's what I was aimed at. As soon as this happened to me, and I came around, and it took about 3 months for me to just get back in, and the profession didn't want to touch me for a long time, because a lot of it is based on, as you know, on confidence.
Yep.
You know, is he up to it? Is he going to flake out in the middle of it? Is he going to do it, Tommy Cooper? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? You know, is he going to die on stage? Where would it leave us? Blah, blah, blah. So it took a long time to fight my way back in. I remember there's a picture of my by then, 2 years, about 2 years later, we'd had another child. And I was still struggling to get back in, and then it happened, and somebody hired me. But the illness, even though I came, and it's significant, even though it felt that, and I used the term miraculous because it was, it didn't just stop there. It didn't go, right, well, now everything's fine. It actually was difficult for a long period after this. And I was trying to reflect on this and saying to my wife that my life has never been, it's like, it's like being out on the ocean. You know, you have a force 10, then you have a force 5, and then you have a period of complete stillness, and you have joy. And the life, for me, it felt like that. You know, you felt lots of great stuff, but a lot of bad stuff as well, punctuated by happiness, children, you know, relationships, all of that kind of stuff, experiences. But the illness was one of those things that I remember so specifically being a major part of my life for quite a long time. And once that kind of thing has happened to you, it's very difficult to look back and go, that didn't happen. It did happen. It was what it was. And
in the latest bumper edition of Sorted magazine, big-name exclusive interviews, Hollywood A-listers, TV adventurer Bear Grylls, inspirational true-life stories, adrenaline-fueled sports features, all this, plus gadgets, entertainment, motoring, movies, and technology, plus probably the greatest team of Christian writers ever assembled. Available now from high street retailers nationwide, or visit sortedmag.com. Sorted. For men. For life.
Jonathan Vieira, one of the perks of our job is travelling a lot, isn't it? Though we are always working, not sightseeing. Tell us about Falstaff in Denmark, one of my favourite places. I've been to Copenhagen half a dozen times. It's beautiful.
It's beautiful, isn't it? And I love Copenhagen. I spent about 10 years there on and off with the opera company. And I was very fortunate to be able to be part of that family for a particular time. And that's what happens. You get associated with an opera house. They use you for everything. And then when they're finished, they move on to somebody else because they've seen every trick that you can do. I think that would be a fair comparison, you know. And this particular time, Falstaff as a character by Verdi, you know, the character from Shakespeare. Mm. And the opera was by Verdi. And I knew it backwards. It was one of the studies that I did at university, and it was fantastic. I love the role. It is the role for me. It is the one that I performed, probably the second most performed role I did in the canon of stuff that I did. But it's beautiful. It's that lovable rogue, which I love as a character. You know, he's flawed centrally, but at the end of it, he says, "Without me, without my nature, and without I'm the salt in the meat, and I am the stuff that makes life worth living." And he's funny, and he's a little bit silly, and he's a bit arrogant, and he's fat, and he's ugly, but the women love him. It's that kind of thing. And he drinks too much, and he's at fault, but then he realizes also that who he is and what he is, and I think it'd be arguable whether he finally recognizes the all the faults in himself, but I think eventually he does. Anyway, I got to do this role, and I was asked to do it at the Verdi Festival in Denmark, and they did about 5 or 6 different operas during that time, and I was the face outside the theatre, massive posters. And when I always used to walk, I shouldn't do this, but I used to walk outside the theatre, the Gamle Scene, the old theatre in Denmark, in Copenhagen, next to the big shopping area, cool, beautiful place.
Yeah.
And I used to stand by the poster, just pretending to just be there and see whether anybody recognised me if they went past. I mean, I know that's ego based, but there you are. I'm just telling you now. A bit narcissistic, a bit Donald Trumpish. But anyway, point was, I did this. And my memory is of the first night. And they'd had this was what's called a revival, which means they'd already done the production. And this was the second time they were doing it. And I was the next person doing Falstaff. It had a very famous singer, this guy Ingvar Wixel. So I went out and did it. And I said, look, I'm going to do it the way I do it. So we spent 6 weeks rehearsing. And I did my Falstaff. I did detailed work on it. And at the end of the show, the Danish people aren't known for their enthusiasm. The Scandinavians, they like it, but they don't do standing ovations. They just don't do it. And I get to the end, and I'm the last person on the stage, and I raise my glass for the audience after singing the song "Tutto nel mondo è burla," which means "Life is a burst of laughter." And it ends with da 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 bum 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 bum. And I raise my glass, and we got through this performance, and the audience roared and all stood. All 1,500 people in the theatre. And it was, I just looked out and I thought, why are they standing?
Yeah.
They're standing for what I've just done. And it was the most emotional I've ever been on stage. And I just wept. I just wept. It was like the culmination of all these things, of all the things that have gone on, the illness, blah, blah, blah. And I took the applause, and the cast, bless them, they pushed me forward to the front of the curtain, and I took probably 10 minutes of bows, and I went back, and they would go, "Oh, Jonathan, you know, full of adulation, full of praise. It was an extraordinary, I was so high, high as a kite. I went out to the stage door, and I signed programs and did all that. And you know, this is the memory that I, having gone through all of that, I stepped out of the theatre and walked towards my hotel. It was as though I was suddenly nobody again.
Yeah.
Because the audiences, people on the street didn't know what I'd just done. The people in the hotel where I went back, in the foyer, they were all sitting around. Nobody to congratulate me. It was just literally, I was going back to my room and just waiting for the next performance in 2 days' time. And I thought, where will I be? I actually thought at that time, where would I be without faith? Mm-hmm. Because it's not enough. The adulation was not enough. And it's such a drug. You want it to continue. You want everything to keep going and keep going. And the memory was walking down outside the theatre to the Hotel Opera. It's called Hotel Opera, which is just opposite the thing. And within the space of 2 minutes, being totally on my own, or I thought, actually, if it weren't the faith, I would have been totally on my own. Mm-hmm. And the futility of just accepting that the world of theatre could be the thing that sustains you. It just wasn't. And you have to have more than that. There has to be more than that. And so,
wow.
It stays with one of those memories. I can actually smell the street.
Yeah. Like,
coming out of the theatre, out of the stage door, and I could smell it, and going back into the hotel, and just going in and going. And I want to say to people, this is me. Do you know what I've just done? Do you know what?
Look at the poster.
Have a look at the poster. Exactly.
Yeah, that's really powerful, John.
You're listening to the Backstory Podcast with Steve Legg and friends. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the memories.
I'm learning some amazing stuff. I mean, I've known you for years, but this is absolutely fascinating. It really is.
Interesting. Can I just say to you, when you asked me about five memories, I said to my wife, there were so many things over 60 years that you kind of go, well, it'll be that, or be that. First time I did that, or the first time I kissed her, or the first time I was, when the children were born, all three of them. All these things come up as incredible memories. And what it's difficult to know how to, filter them out. But do you find that people have issues trying to find five things?
Yeah, sometimes. And I send out a list with, I don't know, about 50 little sort of aid memoirs, first day at school, first kiss, getting a tattoo, and it triggers things. And some people share memories that they'd almost completely forgotten about. And it's absolutely fascinating. It's a lovely concept for a conversation.
It is, actually. It's a great way of doing it.
Thank you.
Forming a program. I love it.
Thank you very much.
I would never thought that. I would have just asked people, a question followed by, as we do on the show each Sunday night.
Yeah.
We get people in and we just ask them about themselves. But this is quite a nice framework. I love it.
Well, it is. I've learned things from friends who I've known for 30, 40 years. And it's just amazing. Yeah. I thought, I never knew that. How interesting. Okay, John, talk to us about your kidneys.
Well, this is it comes full circle, really, I suppose, back to food, because 2.5 years ago, I was admitted to Surrey General Hospital, to the Royal Surrey, with heart and kidney failure, they thought. And I was seriously ill. And kidneys had dropped down in performance to a very low figure. And I was kept in, and they didn't know whether it was heart or kidneys. And eventually they worked out it was kidneys. And they were saying, basically, very soon you're going to have to go on dialysis. Now, the word dialysis is bandied about very simply, though it's a very simple thing. It's probably the worst thing I would have imagined that I could go through, because it stops you living your life. You have to go 3 times a week for 4 hours a go, but effectively it's a 6-hour round trip, and you have to wait. And then it starts to take its toll on the body. It's not a long-term thing for some people. Some people, it's very hard on the heart, and it kills them. Other people can endure it for some time. But everybody's in search of basically the kidney, because there's no cure, as I found out from a dear friend, David Crisp, who's in the unit now that I was in, and he's waiting for a kidney himself. And he said there's no cure. There are treatments for kidney disease, but there's no cure. Well, I was very fortunate in that they put me forward, and they said, you know, if there's anybody, if there's a live donor. But nobody really came forward. And so Sue sat in the meeting where we were talking about it, and they were discussing it, and she just leaned across to me. She said, I'd like to give you mine. Well, wow. Yeah, I mean, this is because you can live with one kidney if you're healthy enough and you can do it. Then I just went, I can't do that. I just started crying. I said, you can't. No, anyway, I'm going to cut a very long story short in saying that she offered the kidney, and then she started going through tests, and I started going through tests and seeing what the match was. And given that we are genetically and racially very different backgrounds, I've got 6 different races in me, and she's pretty much Anglo-Saxon all the way through. And she went through the tests, and they found that it was almost a perfect match, what they call a 1-1-1, which is you can't really get better than that. And long story short, I ended up going into dialysis on December the 8th last year. It was a perfect storm of the pandemic, and then all my numbers dropped at the wrong times, and then they couldn't do the transplant when they said they were going to do it because of pandemic. And so off I went into what was my nightmare, which was a dialysis. And it means that Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that's it, those 3 days, you can't miss it. If you do, then the toxins start to build up, and eventually you just die. If you don't have dialysis, you get iller and iller. 2 months ago tomorrow, Sue gave me one of her kidneys. We had the operation in St. George's in London, and I'm now in recovery, and so is she. So we've been here isolated in the house, but with a new kidney on my right side. It's tucked in, unbelievably, Steve, into my rib cage on the right-hand side. So there it is. It's sitting looking at me, a little bulge. And it's kind of weird. I get tired very quickly. I'll go and have a sleep after this, go and have a sleep in the day. But I'm starting to recover and find my way through this into a new life, and not into 2 months in and no dialysis so far. We're not over the worst of it, but the memory is of feeling, and I'll tell you now, desperate. I wanted to die at various points. I thought, well, actually, just let me die. Ended up recording 2 albums during this period, and I thought, what do we do? And we then, that was Jonathan Vera, Life in the Steinway Room. That's what we do on Facebook and on YouTube on a Sunday night at 8:00. And we did our first one back just this Sunday gone. And it was really, you know, I had to sing, and I hadn't sung out for a long time. And it was a lot of pressure on me, on the wound, a great big wound that I've got. Yeah. But I felt, you know, this is what we could do during this time of where I thought, I can't give anything. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'd rather let me just die. And what she's given me is a new life for however long. We don't know how long it's going to last. the kidney. But do you know what? Let's hope for some years. And in the meantime, you know, we're trying to think about structuring a different life. For most of us out here, this time, pandemic has led us to think all kinds of reprioritizing what is important to us and what's not important to us. Probably more importantly, what's not important to us. And how we can live on so little. I remember you and I talking about this. You know, I haven't had a fee. I've earned £1,600 in fees this year. That's it for singing. It's terrible, that's the least I've ever earned ever in my life from singing. And, you know, we want to get back. But what you've learned is that actually God is good, people are kind, and they help you out, and they bring you food, and they do this, and they give you £100 here for a gift or something. You know, and you survive, and things happen. We the program ended up. We did it out. We just brought our five loads of two fishes, and we said we'll try. What should we do with this? And with the tech team, Rachel, Claire, and Ben, they run the program for us. You know, it's become quite a thing, and we won a BBC award for it. And we've made two albums. We're about to make a third lockdown album, Christmas album. This is all because of doing this thing, and kidneys came into it, and now I've got a new life a little bit, and see what we can do. So it's been a real a roller coaster of a life for the last 16 months. I can tell you that right now, and the last two have been a real challenge in the hospital. Mm. It was quite hard at times. It was difficult. But I think we're through the worst of it now. Watch this space, as I say. You know, there we go.
Wonderful, John.
Connect Radio is the newest radio station to hit the UK. We do things differently and bring you a unique mix of music and entertainment. In fact, we're so unique that we're the only station in the UK to bring you Christian and mainstream music side by side. We promise you'll like what you hear. Download the free app now or visit our website, connectradio.com. Connectradio.com.
Jonathan Vieira, it's been an absolute joy and a pleasure. Let me ask you this. I would like to get into opera, and I'm sure there's lots of people out there, but it does seem a bit, if I'm really honest, a bit highbrow and a bit unattainable. Do you have any tips for any easy access points to get into opera?
Yeah, easy access points is don't go straight for Wagner. That will be my cue to you straight away. Go for something like Madame Butterfly. Be astounded by the human voice and what the human voice can do. Be astounded by the genius of people like Mozart and Puccini and the beauty of what goes on. When you hear, when people hear Nessun Dorma.
Oh, yes.
Nessun Dorma. That one.
Watch those stitches.
That when you hear it, it makes you fit, your hair sticks up on the back of your neck.
Doesn't it?
With Mozart, he's hilarious. He's a genius writing for operas. And so what you do is you get yourself into an accessible point, like The Marriage of Figaro. Mm. Put it on. Just have fun. The Madame Butterfly. Madame Butterfly is the story of Miss Saigon, I think, all over. And the singing is just sheer heaven in places, just absolutely gorgeous. And the music itself, when you get in, there's nothing, when people first come to an opera, and they go into the theatre and the lights go down, and 1,500 to 2,500 people in a theatre, in an English National Opera, over nearly 2,800, 3,000 people. And the lights go down, and the smell, and the sound of the orchestra, and the actual physical thing of the human voice with no microphone. These are all things that you suspend your disbelief and walk into a story which is very other, very different from what you're used to. And what I think, you know, the term elitist has been aimed at it because for so long now that people think it's elitist, but it's not. Because people who are, well, you go to some country like Germany or France, they just turn up in their trainers and their jeans and they watch opera. Mm-hmm. That's what it happens. In this country, it's become a kind of thing with the upper middle classes. You know, that's what we own. And they don't own it. And I used to try and make people belly laugh in opera. That's what I tried to do. And tried to take opera to the masses, because people love to hear good music. That's a good singing. That's what we would try and do. So give it a chance, by going, you've got things like Spotify, and just put in Madame Butterfly, okay, and go in all famous arias by Puccini, and you will listen. Just put that in into your Spotify or Apple Music or whatever it is you've got, and just sit back, put some headphones on, and be blown away. And then what that gives you an access point in, it's the access you need to go in and develop further. I was just listening to the beauty of the Fourier Requiem. It's just a stunning piece of music, and one that moves anybody who listens to it. And I like rock and roll. I'm recording a lot of jazz and blues and lots of other stuff as well. But just give it a chance. Don't go in with preconceived notions. And what you'll end up with is an open heart and something ready to give it a shot. Come back to me and say, JV, you were right. Once again, JV, you were right.
You're not often wrong. You know, listen, one last question, mate.
That's one
of my answers,
yeah. Another one.
I bet she does. One last question, because you have to have your afternoon nap.
I will.
Are you still dreaming? Have you got some unfulfilled ambitions?
Isn't that interesting you should ask that? Because coming out of the operation, I ended up speaking to my record producer, as I said, Mark Edwards, who's this world-beating jazz pianist and a famous guy off with Katie Melio at the moment, touring, and when it's allowed. And we just said about what we put with recording. We talk about recording, they're living artifacts of what I do, what I want to do. So what I do is I record stuff that I want to do. That's what these two lockdown albums, Lockdown Sessions 1, Lockdown Sessions 2, you can get them from jonathanvera.com, and we sell them directly. They were crowdfunded to the tune of £20,685 from the community, and we were able to record two albums. And what we've decided in the future is I want to take the show out, the Unlockdown Tour, JV, the Unlockdown Tour. But I want to do things differently. I want to live a little bit of, I want to go touring Ireland and Scotland. I just want to go there and see things. And live the life that you think, when people talk about retiring. I don't want to wait till I'm retired, because actually I might not have that long. And so a lot of us have lived this in the expectation of the future, that it will all be when we retire. And I just say to people now, do it. If you want to do it, go and do it. Go and find the time and do it. And so things like I want to do JV at 60, I want to do a few concerts with my boys again, and with Mark Edwards and Raoul d'Oliveira and some Flugelhorn. I want to get that out there, and I want people just, dancing in the aisles and enjoying great music. That's what I want. I want to be out there doing it again. So let's not limit ourselves to what we can do. Just try and dream a dream. It won't always come true, but actually part of the thing is to start planning. Start planning and see where it will take you. That's what Mark and I were talking about. Let's see where it takes us. Let's see what we can do next. Because the story's not finished. The story's not finished. We don't end with pandemic. This is, and I think there's this constant and never-ending flow of news and information, of depressing information from this epidemiologist and from that doctor, and we'll always have to wear masks, and we'll always have to do this, and it will never be the same again, and it's doom and gloom. And I'm just saying, actually, no, I want to do more than doom and gloom. I'd like to actually live a life. I'd like to, have I lost you?
No, I'm here. This is fascinating.
No, and just that. I mean, just dream a little. That's all. I don't know. I don't know. Become a magician. Do a show where I sing and you do a trick. You cut me in half. Whilst I'm singing.
Love it, John. The story's not finished. It certainly isn't.
You're listening to the Backstory Podcast, where we remember the good times, the things you love, the things you are, the things you never want to lose.
So there we go. Thanks so much for listening right to the very end. It'd be great if you can do me a quick favour before you go. Simply head over to wherever you get your podcasts and rate us 5 stars. And leave a glowing review too. It really does make a massive difference. Then
Quite simply, we shoot up the charts, more people listen, and it really is happy days. Thanks a million.
You've been listening to the Backstory Podcast with Steve Legg and friends. Catch you next time.